Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with Edward Gerow, who is currently portraying Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia in the Oslo Repertory Theatre production of The Originalist, a play which was actually written with him in mind and gave him the extraordinary opportunity of meeting, getting to know with, hanging out with the justice himself. Listen to the way that Ed discovered his career, which is in itself an interesting story, and the story of his relationship with the justice he is portraying. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. Finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no. Resources all on tap. Oh, I really can. Oh, I really can. Turn down all the noise so
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you should be. Not the person other people told you to be or the person other people are, but the person you really are. As a therapist, it's clear to me that so many of us are demonstrating a person which may be a version of us but isn't actually the whole truth about us. Too many of us have learned in our childhood that some aspect of ourselves, something we did, something we said, some way that we looked, some interest we had, was not approved of, accepted, understood by some important aspect of our life, our family of origin, a school, a teacher, a religious organization, some way we were. Was bringing us a consequence we did not want. Teasing, embarrassment, neglect, punishment. And so we learn to hide those aspects of ourselves which were bringing us something we didn't want and leading with qualities we thought people would want. But what this means is that we come into adulthood quite often without access to all of who we really are. And that is a very pale and unsuccessful. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And in my interview with Ed Gero, you can hear what it sounds like to be who Ed is. This is a wonderful story of a man who was so clear about what was right for him, who he really was, where his passion lay, where his comfort level was. Listening to Ed, you know that you are hearing from authenticity, which again, as a therapist, I believe is the most important thing we can have in our life, to be our authentic self. And so here now is the authentic Edward Gero. Okay, so I'm here with Ed Gero, and I'm interviewing Ed because he is portraying Antonin Scalia in the production of The Originalist at the Oslo Repertory Theater. So I'm explaining to Ed that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that the art to which you are giving your life and hopefully making your living is the art of acting.
It is, the art of theater.
The art of theater.
And in particular, acting.
Okay, good. So the question I ask is, can you tell me, do you remember the very first moment in your life when you were drawn to, thought about acting, stories, play acting?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good.
Well, it evolved. I sort of stumbled upon the cardinal rule of acting. I didn't know that at the time, but I stumbled upon it when I was an altar boy.
Really?
Yeah.
How old?
Well, I guess it would have been maybe 11, 10 or 11. And I grew up in an Italian American family in New Jersey, and went to Catholic school. And of course, you know, at that time in the 60s, everyone was participating as altar boys and so forth. So here it was 6:30 Mass, and I'm on the altar, and Father Callahan was saying the Mass, and he was half asleep. I mean, let's face it; it was 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah,
I appreciate that now. I didn't then. And he got to the point of the center of the Mass, which is the consecration, and he just seemed to be going through the motions. And I thought to myself, if you just did that like you believed it,
oh, wow,
everybody else would believe it.
Wow, at 10 or 11.
So I was also fortunate enough to be introduced to a play in seventh grade, still in grammar school. I think The Sound of Music had just come out as a film, and all the gals in the class were enamored of the musical. So one of the gals, young student, seventh grader, created a little adaptation of the play of the movie. Of course, the play was already out, had been out on Broadway, and there were auditions, and I was one of the two guys that showed up at the auditions because I thought this would be fun, this would be interesting. And I ended up being cast as Captain Von Trapp, and I learned how to play the guitar, and I found myself out on stage, and I thought, this feels like home to me.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I had grown up with older siblings. There weren't a lot of kids in my neighborhood, so it was a bit of a loner childhood. So this sort of, as I said, it made me feel like I was at home. I was in a group of students. It didn't matter what your ethnic background was, what side of the tracks you came from, if you were willing to sort of pitch in and play, you were welcome. I thought, I like this. And then we did another one the following year.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
I want to back up a little bit.
Sure.
I'm absolutely fascinated with your recognition as an altar boy that if the priest behaved as though he believed it, the people would believe it.
Exactly.
This is not only a statement about acting, but this is a statement about It's more
faith?
Yes.
Certainly.
Yes.
Totally.
And that you had that then,
mm-hmm.
that it could be important to you,
mm-hmm.
that he make this point, that he believe it,
right.
that you felt
that
cheated.
Exactly. He shared the same fervor that I was experiencing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so you and by extension everybody else was cheated from what you could be getting there.
That's right. I suppose I could have become a critic.
You could have become a priest.
Well, that was the next step.
Yes. And
that's what I thought it was. You see?
Right.
So I actually did feel this calling and went into a sort of high school pre-seminary kind of situation. And that's what I thought was going on. And after some reflection, I realized that wasn't it, and I suppose it was because I didn't want to have to do the same show for the rest of my life or wear the same costume. My mother said to me, she said, look, God can have you the rest of your life. I want 4 years in a public institution. So I went to a public high school.
Okay, hold on. Back up. I'm really actually pretty fascinated by this, the leap
mm-hmm.
that you make
mm-hmm.
from wanting the priest to present with
conviction.
Conviction, thank you, that's the word I'm looking for, right,
yeah.
With conviction. And then, you know, it makes perfect sense that what you would have wanted to do after that was to do what he wasn't doing.
Exactly.
Right. And to bring what he wasn't bringing.
Right.
Right? Okay,
right.
Great. Okay, so in the seventh grade, there wasn't a drama class or
no,
something,
no,
right?
No.
Okay, so this young girl creates this adaptation.
Right.
How does she put it on?
It was this wonderful nun who said this.
Oh, is this a Catholic school?
Oh, yeah, this is a Catholic school.
Oh, I had no idea.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And of course, The Sound of Music. Very,
sure. Oh, yeah,
very
it works right hand in glove with Catholic education.
Right? Yes.
Let's do this, sure.
Right.
So her name was Sister Frances, and she said she would sponsor it. She put it together.
So was there an auditorium? Did you do it in class?
We had the gym, and there was a raised platform at the end of the gym, like most. And we put it on. We built scenery and costumes, and it was I think it was the first time ever in the history of the school that something like that was ever done.
Who directed it?
The nun.
The nun. Of course
oh,
she
yeah.
did. Of course she did.
God bless her.
Do you? No kidding. No
right.
kidding.
Right, really? Without
right.
her, I wouldn't
right.
be here.
No, that's exactly
totally.
Right. Without an inadequate priest
right.
and a forward-thinking nun.
Right. That's right.
Right? We don't have you.
Well, I can tell you what. One of them stayed in the church and one did not. And I bet you can guess who left the church.
Yes.
That would have been Sister Frances.
Well, and I'm really curious about this. Yeah. Did she have history or interest in the theater? Do you know?
No idea.
Fascinating. That's really fascinating. Okay.
I think she had interest in the students and was interested in supporting whatever impulse to express or learn or
grow.
Do. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I always like to stop at this point to say, teachers, they make all the difference.
Absolutely.
They make all the difference. You are not the only person I have interviewed who a teacher somehow intervened in their life and helped them choose, and quite often an acting career,
right.
oddly
right.
enough, but still.
That was She was just the first. There were several of them
along the way. Oh, good. I want to hear about
several
all of them.
Along the way.
Okay. So you're even when you're doing The Sound of Music, mm-hmm. you're still thinking probably priest or maybe priest.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? Okay. And they... Oh, so in the Catholic school, they have this pre-seminary thing. This is not...
This was at a different place. This was at a different seminary. It was a different school. It was a sort of a summer program, 3 months of reflection. This was I grew up in northern New Jersey in a town called Madison, and this other seminary was in Princeton. So it was an order, and this was a program they offered for young people who had thoughts of becoming and having a vocation.
Okay, so the other question that leaps out at me is, it seems that you came from a religious family,
mm-hmm.
a family to whom faith was important,
mm-hmm.
a Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
Often, Catholic mothers want their sons.
Right.
Right? So your mother does this other thing.
She does this other thing.
Which is fascinating. Yeah. Are you not the only son? Was there someone else?
I'm the only son.
Holy cow, so to speak. Sorry.
In that family.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So what do you think that was about?
I think she just wanted to give me a broader perspective and knowing that, you know, what their relationship was with the church or with the societies around it, or the, you know, my dad was in the Knights of Columbus and so forth, and he knew the priests, he knew the sort of ins and outs of how the church operated.
So they maybe didn't want that for you for other reasons.
I think they didn't want that for me.
Yeah.
And they wanted to at least give me the opportunity to have my own, find my own way from a different perspective.
Yeah, to make a choice.
Exactly.
Right. And they
certainly... Which is pretty forward-thinking, I mean, from my folks. You know, they were second-generation Americans. They were working their way. My mom was a domestic. She cleaned houses. She took in laundry at night. And my dad was a local UAW president for 30 years. So they were, you know, working class.
I don't think forward-thinking cuts it. I think they were amazing.
Well,
you know, really.
Yeah,
no
yeah.
kidding.
Yeah.
You were lucky in so many ways.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah,
right.
It's true.
Right. Because it could have gone a whole lot of
right.
other ways, right? And you could be one of those inadequate priests today, very sorry
right.
that you're doing what you're
right.
doing.
That's right.
Right? Okay, so so you discover, and of course the other thing that you say about discovering a home on stage and with other people who are interested in this work is quite common
right.
for people who wind up in the profession, right?
Right?
So we have you, so your mother says, fine, a public school
right.
for high school,
right? Then
right?
Then I go to the public high school in town, and there... At that time, there were drama classes and there were speech classes. Perhaps it was the last time in American education that was part of the curriculum.
Lucky again.
Very lucky again with art education. And that became a cause celeb for me later on in life because of this experience. So I took a couple of drama classes, speech class, and it was great fun. And my freshman year, it was my second semester freshman year, I took a drama class. And with older students, but having had this experience, of course, grammar school, I thought, well, I got this.
You know, yeah, I'm ahead
of the
game.
I had success already.
You were a star.
Exactly. It was a very tiny pond, but there it was. And there we had an audition again for a Greek tragedy. I thought, okay, I'll do that. And I auditioned, and it was the Trojan Women. And
it's an interesting choice for high school.
You have to remember this would be 1968.
Mm-hmm.
It was an anti-war play.
Ah, yes.
We were in Vietnam.
Oh, God, right.
You know.
Oh, 68.
Yeah, Nixon had just been elected. Well, not yet. He was running. So this would have been 69, so he would have been elected, but it was just after the Chicago Convention the previous summer. And here we were doing this anti-war play as part of, the movement that was occurring, and I got cast as the messenger of the Greek messenger, which is the big male role in the play. So here I was again, given this opportunity as a youngster, you know, beyond some upperclassmen, and I got this opportunity. So, and that was a great success, and it was again because of a teacher. The name is Jim Albertson. He's still around. Actually, he has a radio show. He does a folk music show out of Atlantic City area. I just sort of fell into this and took it on whole hog. Madison has an old cemetery, a sort of Revolutionary War cemetery, on this hill. And most of the kids would go there in the summertime to get away, just to sort of, you know, sneak away. Who's going to go to a cemetery? but it was, you know, old 18th century stones and so forth. And I would go there and I'd rehearse my lines.
In the cemetery?
Yeah, I'd run up the hill, and as I was the messenger, and I'd deliver these lines about the burning towers of Ilium to, you know, these dead. And, of course, it would have been dead in the scene.
Yes,
you know,
Troy, right, it's perfect.
So it was, you know, it was crazy. And
it's method.
I guess so. It was. That's when I realized with that opportunity, with that teacher, with Jim, that I said, oh, that's what this is. It's not the priesthood. It's the theater.
That's what it is. Yeah. It is, right?
Yeah. That's what this calling is.
Yes.
I can sense, and of course, you know, the theater emerged as a religious festival, so the spirit was still part of it, and certainly with the Greeks. And then we had a great program we did after that. We did Shakespeare. It was my first Shakespeare in high school. We did Arthur Miller. We did Dürrenmatt. We did these great plays. And then there's also a musical program. So if you weren't on the football team in my high school, it was okay to be on the musicals. So then I started doing musicals. I auditioned for my first musical. I was scared out of my mind. I mean, I know I had done, you know, Sound of Music, but this was big time. And I was very nervous, and I auditioned for... Judd Fry. I got cast as Judd.
Wow.
As a sophomore. And then things just kept going. And so I ended up spending my high school career doing four plays a year, because we would do a drama in the fall and in the spring. And then in the wintertime, we did the musical. And then there was a summer program of musicals. So I would do two musicals and two straight plays a year. It was a great education.
It's a great education.
Both teachers that I had in the drama program came from the same college, so I said, "Well, that's the college I need."
Okay, hold on. I want to flip back to to something else you said that I like to highlight whenever it comes up, and fortunately, it comes up a lot. So that was the moment that I knew what it was, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That there was an it, that there was a calling, that there was a reason for me, that there was something I was meant to do.
Impelled to do it.
Impelled to do it, yeah. I like to point out as often as I can that it's possible to know that. Not everybody is fortunate to know it at 13. Mm. Not everybody is fortunate to know it ever. Lots of people are not.
Right.
But it is possible to know it.
Right.
And I actually don't think it's ever too late to know it, even if you didn't get it.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Right. So I just like to say it whenever somebody says it, and see? Essentially, that's what you know.
Of course, that doesn't guarantee anything that you ever manifest it, but or actualize it, but it certainly felt, I had a very clear sense that this was, it energized me. I just recognized how I felt. I felt I had more confidence than I'd ever felt before. I just had a relaxation about myself that I ever felt before. The searching felt like it was over.
Yeah. And see, you've made both of the points that I think are important here. One of them, all that you know it because your life changes.
Totally.
You know, because you change, because you relax into your life, right? The search is over. I love
it.
And
there's a mission. I mean,
there's a mission.
You're on a mission now.
Exactly. And the other point that you made, which I think is really important to say, that the outcome is not important.
No, exactly right.
Right? The, like, having that is what's important. You know, maybe you will be successful at it, maybe you won't.
Right.
But you will always be ahead of the game because you have... that.
There was an audacity then, though, that, of course, in retrospect, you say there was no focus on the outcome, although not at the time.
No.
I absolutely wanted to have an outcome. I absolutely wanted to get in that play, and when I didn't get in that play, it would break my heart. And
yes.
I was totally committed to it. And that understanding came much later.
Yeah.
But absolutely.
And then that doesn't always come to everybody either, but never mind.
Right.
Okay, fine. So clearly you make up your mind you have to go to this college, which is?
Montclair State.
Oh, good. Stay in New Jersey.
Stay in New Jersey. So I'm still in New Jersey. Now, there was a little bit of resistance from my parents because they, you know, they were concerned, of course, for my well-being.
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm thinking, well, we wanted him to make a choice, and we wanted him to have an exposure, but we didn't expect him to be a goddamn actor.
Exactly right. So they were very, very suspicious of these teachers. Like, what are they doing to my kid?
Yeah, right.
You know, and it wasn't until, I think, people would come up to my parents, my dad, mom, after plays and say, wow, he's so talented, isn't that fantastic? When they started to get the kudos, then they lightened up on me, right? And Montclair was had a great reputation as a drama school. Both of these teachers that I had over the 4 years of college had come from there. There was a teaching college at the time. but had some great teachers there. So, and they actually came out and saw me, talked to my folks, and said, you know, he should really come with us. And so
I, oh, Montclair came out.
They recruited a little bit.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not wrong in assuming that your teachers had a little something to do
with
that?
I think so. I don't know the background, but I know now talking about it now, they must have.
They must have, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, had that happen.
Right. So this is a natural thing for you.
Right.
Right. This came with the territory of being Ed.
Correct.
Right. Okay, good. I just...
Totally part of my identity from the very beginning.
Right. Yeah. It just took a little while for you to figure out where it went, right. Okay, good. Yeah. So now you're in college.
Right. So now I'm in college. And terrific teachers, Jerry Rockwood in particular, who had written a book called The Craftsman of Dionysus. That book was used in most universities across the country at the time. He was a protege of Stella Adler, and the school very close to New York. Dennis McDonald was also a teacher of mine who sort of took me under his wing. He lived in New York. His partner was having a Broadway career at the time, going from musicals to dramas. Again, just threw myself at it and threw caution to the winds, took all the classes, auditioned for everything, and things went very well there, too. I think the first thing I did was a musical. We did cabaret, and I got the non-singing part, but I didn't care. Again, a freshman in the cabaret, that was, you know, in the big musical, was great. But we did a varied group of plays, and then there was also the student groups that were producing as well. So we were working all the time and learning. And about halfway through, I thought, well, maybe I should go to a different school, Yale or whatever.
Well, you were now being exposed to what was out there in terms of your career.
Now, and of course, all this time, because we were so close to New York, even from high school days, we were getting on the train and going in to see plays.
For $10,
you can get on a train, you can go to New York, you can buy a ticket,
right?
And still have, and at that time, at 16 or 15, 16, you still had enough money to go downtown to the village and have a beer, because it was okay to drink at 18, so we started a little early.
Yeah, right.
But
right,
that was all part of the scene. Mm-hmm. So we saw so many great plays. Shakespeare. During that time, it was Jim who took me to New York to see Hamlet with a group of us. And then in the summertime, we went to the Delacorte, and I saw Stacy Keach in Peer Gynt and Hamlet. And this was probably the greatest Hamlet of my experience. You know, we had James Earl Jones as Claudius and Colleen Dewhurst as Gertrude and Sam Waterston as Laertes and Barney Hughes as Polonius and Raoul Julia was Osric.
Oh my God.
It was an unbelievable cast, and Stacy Keach is playing Hamlet. And I didn't know from Stacy Keach. I mean, I'd seen him the year before, but I saw this guy and I thought, wow, I want to be like that guy. Because it was physical, it was emotional, he spoke it beautifully. I understood everything he said. It made perfect sense to me. And he had an amazing impact. I said, I knew I wanted to be an actor, but I wanted to be a classical actor. I wanted to do this kind of material.
So, again, when you saw it, you knew it?
I knew it immediately.
Yeah.
I went back and saw that production 5 times. I knew I was seeing something important, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it.
Oh, my God.
I went back again and again and again.
At 16, 17?
17, 16, 17, yeah. Mm-hmm. So 30 years later, when Stacy Keach comes down to the Shakespeare Theater and does Richard III and I'm in it with him, here it is, closing that circle. And we've since become great friends, and every single Shakespeare piece he's done since then I've been in.
Oh, my God.
So at the end of that story is Stacy Keach playing King Lear and I'm playing Gloucester.
Oh.
So here I am, his number two. And I thought, this is as good as this gets. So again, this sort of serendipitous...
Or whatever you call
it. Whatever you want to call it.
right.
Synchronicity, who knows what
right,
it is.
Right.
Intention, I don't know.
Right. Kismet,
yeah,
karma.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, yeah. So I think there's, without planning, this is what you were talking about earlier, about what the outcome is.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have planned for that outcome.
No.
I couldn't even conceived of that outcome.
Right.
So the outcomes are actually greater than you could, it seems to me, in my experience... They're greater than what you can possibly imagine, including this project I'm working on now.
As long as you are true to that thing, That's what I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
You know, because the outcome may or may not be what it was for you, but as long as you're true to that thing, then you really, I want to say, one cannot have regret because one is oneself.
Yeah, well, I think true to yourself. You have to be true to yourself. And that's, you know, thank you, Polonius and Shakespeare.
Yeah, right.
You know, you have to be true to yourself.
Yes, and of course we know what happened to him.
Well, it's
true. Never mind.
Right.
Okay, so did you change colleges?
No. Dennis McDonald said, look, there are two ways to learn how to act. One is you can learn it in the classroom. The other is you can learn it on the stage. And I said, so are you telling me you're going to hire me here for the next 2 years? He said, yes. I said, okay, I'll stay.
You're kidding.
No.
What did he hire you
well,
as?
Well, it cast me in play.
Yes, right. Then he would continue to put you on stage.
Exactly. So then at the close to New York, going into New York, my senior year, I auditioned for a company in New York called CSC Rep. And I had seen some of their work earlier. They did a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, I remember, and it was fabulous. And so there was an open call. And I went to the open call. And I got cast.
Wow.
And so I went back to the university and said, okay, I'm gone.
Well, wait a minute.
This is my senior year.
Oh, my God.
This is the fall of my senior year.
Right,
I said, I've got a job in New York. I'm going to go. And again, Dennis came to my rescue and said, no, actually it was Howard Fox who founded the program many years earlier. Hold on. He said, we'll create an internship. So Montclair gave me 15 credits of a full semester to do this, as long as I came back and reported about it. And,
yeah, know, wrote papers and all that stuff, right.
So in the midst of that, and I was so excited about that, in the midst of that, they had and I was working with, who was in that company? Ron Perlman was
oh
in that
my.
Company.
Oh, my.
Stuart Vaughn, who had directed for PAP several times, Ed Ciciarelli, Tom Fitzgibbons, great, great actors. And, you know, I'm this kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm doing Shakespeare in New York. I thought, okay. They went belly up. And I was driving, commuting in from New Jersey. And I said, look, I just need to have car fare. And they said, no, you can't. You know, and they said, you really don't. You're really not committed to your art. You prefer your bourgeois lifestyle to your...
Who said this to you?
This is the artistic director of the company. We weren't going to invite you back anyway. So I was crushed.
No kidding. Well,
crushed.
And as I can, unless I'm very wrong, this is the very first disappointment in this career.
This is it. This is huge, right?
Right.
This is it. So I said, well, if it's like this, then, you know, I wasn't prepared for the psychological...
No, of course not. Well, how would you? You hadn't had
it was
a disappointment.
So far.
Exactly,
yeah, I mean,
right.
The disappointments that
coast,
I had were like
coast,
small.
Coast crash.
Yeah, right. So I had to regroup and
well, so now are you finished with school yet?
No, this is midway
you're still
through
in the,
school.
Oh my God. Okay. And you're on this internship, but now what happens?
Well, now I go back to that was for the first semester. So now I go back and I propose doing in response to that. I proposed doing my own one-person show. So I spent the entire semester researching.
As part of the internship.
To finish my degree.
Right.
I took a couple of classes, maybe one or two, but the bulk of it was working on the show. So I read everything that at that point that Samuel Beckett had written, and I developed a 50-minute monologue, and I did Crab's Last Tape, and I had a fellow student do the set design. This had never been done before at Montclair. So this sort of became the model for their internship program and the model for their sort of BA thesis project.
Terrific.
It became BFA the next year.
Yeah.
So I was sort of pushing the envelope for them and so forth. So that's what I did. And then went off for a while to get together with myself a little bit and figure out, is this really something I want to do? Because
having graduated.
Well, yes. And having had this experience in New York, I thought, wow.
Right.
I don't know if this is going to stop being fun. I'm not going to do this anymore.
Uh-huh.
This isn't fun. And how do I prepare for that? So
I don't want to stop you. If this isn't fun is such an interesting way to talk about if they're going to break my heart.
Right.
You know.
Right.
You know. It's closer to that, isn't it?
I suppose it is. Yeah, it is. But it was there. What I had experienced about, you know, the sense of collaboration and the sense of openness and the sense of, you know, that sort of spirit thing that's part of what we do.
Oh, yes.
When that was not there, then I said, well,
Yeah.
What's motivating you then? What's this about? So then it became about the power politic and beginning to understand that whole
the political. That not everybody is doing what you're doing.
For the same reason.
For the same reason. Totally. That's what I meant. Right.
Yeah. That's what I had to sort of, you know, piece out. So I went off to, even still, I went off to learn how to tend bar in the Pocono Mountains with the eye of going into New York, right? Because if I'm going to go to New York, I need to
have something to take with me.
Sure, I've got to pay the rent. But now the leap, the big leap was now into New York, and I was going to pursue this dream. Probably the most significant event of my young life happened at the end of this summertime. I was in a car with a young man. At the end of it was the last day of work. We had finished work, and by a series of circumstances, we ended up driving off a 150-foot cliff in this car. And there I was, off. That was it. I figured that's it. That's it.
It's over. Oh my God!
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, really.
That's what I said. So here we were.
He
was driving. It was just this crazy series of circumstances. I was tending bar, and he was one of the waiters, and we became friends. So that the last night of the season, there was an after hours bar, and all the waiters and bartenders went out there, and of course everyone was half in the bag. We're 20 year old kids rather. And he lost control of the car. Going down this hill, and off we went at 65 miles an hour. And I said, "Oh, that's it. I'm done. Lights out." You know, and there was a certain relaxation about that. You know,
yes.
I was like, "No." Well, that's it. And the next thing I knew, I'm sitting in the car, and survived that, and so did he. And we, 4 hours later, after being observed at the hospital, we were released. I had a sprained ankle or something. No injuries. I thought, well, this is. I'm not done.
Apparently not.
Felt miraculous to me.
Yes.
You know, that was the experience of it. And I thought, okay, I've got my work's not finished. I'll know when my work is finished when I'm dead.
Right.
So I'll get on with it.
Right.
And so that sort of.
Wow.
You know, I spent the next couple of months just sort of going around and seeing all my friends saying, hey, hi, I'm alive. How are you? Life is good. No, life is good.
Yeah, right.
Right. So I sort of like had a little bit of an enlightenment moment there to say, no matter what happens, we're still above ground, so let's keep going.
Yeah, right.
So then I said, okay, I go back to New York.
Yeah.
I get it. And I pursued it there and found another teacher. I had, in that time when I was thinking about going to another school, I had wanted to audition for RADA.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in classical theater now. I had seen Stacey Keach. And we all went away to spring break to Puerto Rico, and I ended up on St. John by myself because my friends, I said, let's go. They said, okay. And then when it came time to go, they didn't go. I said, fine, I'm going by myself. I'll get on the plane. And I'm sitting on the beach. I'm thinking, what am I doing? Why am I applying for RADA? I can't even spell my name theatrically. So why am I even thinking about it? I didn't go. I was probably just too afraid of the rejection I might get. So I'm in New York now, and who do I meet but a woman who taught at RADA for 25 years,
oh my God.
Who is now teaching privately in New York. And a friend of mine was in the class, and I said, I'd like to audition. She said, oh, forget it. You can't get into Ada's class. It's impossible. And 2 weeks later, she said, I don't believe it. There's an opening. She won't come in and audition. And I got in. So now I'm with Armin Shimerman, who you may know from Deep Space Nine. And, you know, we're all studying. 10 of us are studying with Ada. So I get the education that I wanted postgraduate. And
yet again,
it's just crazy how the thing sort of unfolded.
Yes.
Right. And that led to a play in Virginia that she was directing. So I went down to do that. I formed a relationship with this theater that then came to Washington for a winter season. And the person who was running the Folger Theater saw the opening night and came downstairs and said, would you like to join the company?
Uh-huh.
Which I did, and that precipitated the move to Washington, where I've been for the last 30 years.
Oh, my God.
So at the end of the first season, they invited me back, and I said, well, I can go back to New York and look for work, or I can stay
here and work.
do the work I was trained to do. And that's how it happened. So we went on to building the community of Washington Theater. When I got there, there were 5 theaters, and now there are 85.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And again, It just evolves for you.
Yeah, I mean, looking backwards, it looks like it was written.
Yes, I was just going to say, it looks like it was written. Yeah. That's exactly right.
But going
right.
forward, you can't see that.
Just to make this point, going forward, you can't see it.
Right.
Don't try.
Yeah, no, it's...
Just keep putting one foot in front of...
No, you just the be in the
where,
moment.
Where
be in the moment.
Right, but where your foot feels like it should be.
That's where it is.
That's where it is.
Well, it's... Yeah, it should be where it is.
Yeah, it should be where it is.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
You can't be any other place than where you are, so you might as well be where you are, because that's where it's happening.
Except that so many people are trying to be someplace else.
Well,
right,
you know,
right.
As a teacher of acting now, that's one of the things I contend with all the time.
Yes.
You know, you're focusing on what isn't, and what's really happening on stage is what is. That's always alive, and the other stuff is always dead. So what are you doing?
Why
are you spending any time with that?
Yeah. Okay, now, so here you are in the originalist as Antonin Scalia.
That's right.
Yes. So talk about the play.
This is an amazing play. John Strand has put his finger on the pulse. A Washingtonian writer who I was fortunate enough that John wrote the play with me in mind.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. And he went to Molly Smith and said, I've got this idea to this play about Antonin Scalia with Ed. And Molly would say, you know, she felt the hair raise up in the back of her neck and said, yeah, let's go for this. Fascinating. There's never been a play written about a sitting justice. He wrote the play around the dissent of the Defense of Marriage Act 2 years prior to when the Obergefell hearing would be held. And I had the opportunity to meet and become friends with the justice.
Oh, my goodness.
And spent his final full year at court on several occasions, going to hearings and having lunch in chambers and going out to dinner, going skeet shooting with him and his
You're kidding.
Clerks. Oh, yeah. No.
Oh, my God.
That was amazing. So
there's a book in this.
Well, there is. You know, and everybody in my universe would say, you better write it.
You look like you're blushing a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah, I've never played an Italian-American in my life.
Never mind that you are one.
Right?
That's right.
Never mind that he is one.
Yeah,
never
no,
mind
right.
that we're both Roman Catholic. Never mind that we're both born in New Jersey.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
And I said to him, of course, I don't have a 45-pound brain, but you know. But
you can act like you do.
I can pretend like
yes,
it. Exactly. Right. It's much easier to do
that's
that.
Right.
So this play, although John has written a really... really smart play.
Did he read it? No.
Didn't read it. Didn't see it. His son saw it. Some family, close friends. No, and the very first thing he said to me in chambers was, "Look, I just want you to know I'm not coming to see the play, but I'm glad they got somebody good to do it, so I won't be embarrassed. Let's have some lunch." So
wow.
It was off the table.
And do you know why?
Well, after the lunch, I was counseled to invite him to a closed rehearsal. Because, look, if
oh,
Nino
God,
Scalia
right.
showed up at the show
oh, yeah,
without
right.
him, no
right.
one's going to be watching the play.
No, that's right.
Right?
But that can't have been his motivation.
Well,
why
not? Why not? Because it wasn't, why would he want to upstage? He could read it to find out what it's about.
Yes, did he?
Nope.
So then that's not what it's about.
Well, here's what he said. I invited him to a closed rehearsal.
Right.
And he said... okay. And then 2 days before, he said, you know, on second thought, it's not a good idea, and I'll tell you why. He said, if I come to see the play, and people ask me what I thought, if I say that I liked it, and parenthetically, he said, and I'm sure I will find things in it that will be unfair, everyone will think I'm endorsing the whole play. If I say I didn't like it, I'll be accused of being thin-skinned.
Well, he's right.
He said, I can't. He said,
he can't win.
Exactly.
He can't win.
I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't. People would say to me, how can you play that role? And he's awful and I can't. I said,
I'm really so glad you brought this up because I have been curious about this question. So many people disagreed with him about so much.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But you're an actor.
Well, exactly. And you know, well, my job is to, you know, I have to love the characters that I play.
That's right.
I have to. Sure. I certainly have to walk a mile in the shoes and figure out...
Exactly.
Pretty interesting shoes to walk in.
Yeah.
Now, politics aside, we never spoke about politics.
Really?
Never. Why would I do that?
Well, no, I think that's...
Because then it would... Because I just wanted to have the relationship as a human being.
With the man, right.
And that's what Absolutely. We did. Because right. after that, after he said that about the play, then we got to talk about Italy and family and church.
And right, right. Music, and life.
And life.
Yes.
So I'm not a politician. I'm not an attorney. I have no axe to grind. Plus, we have a mutual interest in having this relationship work out.
Yes.
And I knew that going in. Right?
Yes, yes.
I mean, he knows I'm going to be representing him on stage.
Yeah.
So he's going to...
Yes, he's going to give you everything he can.
And
that's
he did
right.
on the bench, and he did. He well, and of course, I want to keep this relationship going. I want to, you know, I want to have bona fides, right?
Right.
You know, I'd done my homework, and I talked about how my approach to teaching Shakespeare and interpreting Shakespeare might be analogous to his textualism notion about the Constitution. Let's look at semantics and syntax and grammar.
Oh, very nice.
Well, it's true. I mean, that's what I've been doing for 30 years.
No, not that, but that you knew it, that you made that leap, that connection, that you knew it. So maybe it's not 45 pounds, but it's a good brain.
Well, I've been working on Shakespeare for a long time, so, you know, he's got a lot more cases to have to remember.
Well, and he's also, isn't he also an iconic figure? He's almost Shakespearean, isn't he?
He's totally Shakespearean.
Yeah,
he's
right.
Great, you know,
he's a Lear in a way, isn't he? Right.
He's the justice.
Yes, that's right. He's the justice. That's correct. God,
he's
justice itself.
Yeah, and he filled it out.
And he loved it.
He loved it.
He loved it. Right.
He died, what we would call a very good Catholic death. He went to sleep and never woke up. And, you know, he had health issues. I mean, he's a 79-year-old man who loved to eat.
Right.
He would smoke for many years. And he ran a schedule of a 45-year-old. So at 79, you know, that generation, my dad died at 76.
Yeah, yeah. I read about it.
Conspiracy stuff around it was so hurtful.
Yes.
It was really hurtful.
Well, but in that sense, it's kind of tragic, isn't it?
Yeah, yes.
You know, that was done to him.
But he would say, what can they do to me?
Yeah, well, he's right.
What can they do to me? But he said that in life.
Right.
Well, that's what he said about the play.
Yeah.
He said, if that's the worst they say about me, what can they do to me?
Yeah. Well, okay, you good. Know. Okay.
But, no, I think he had a really interesting balance between this sort of sensibility, the sensitivity, but yet he had, like an actor, he had this
persona.
Skin. He had the skin.
Mm. Oh, yeah, right.
He could take it.
Yeah, right.
He could take it. Because what they do at the court, most people really don't understand. They are to me like 9 tenured full professors doing committee work in a collegial way, and in the great Socratic classroom of the United States of America. It's a Socratic classroom.
You know, something else occurred to me when we talked about his not wanting to read the play.
Mm.
I mean, because I really understand the not wanting to see it in any kind of public setting.
Right.
Any way where anybody's going to ask him what he thought. I really understood that. That was lose-lose for him. But not reading the play, what that says to me is his ego is not involved. No. He doesn't care what you're saying about
Precisely.
Him. Right? I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Precisely.
Right? He's beyond it or above it or whatever, right?
It's what can they do to me?
Exactly.
What he liked was hearing from his colleagues and friends who saw the play and went, "Oh my God!"
Oh, really?
Oh yeah. Oh, he said he called me to get tickets. He said, "I can't get. You're just so darn successful. You know, I'll pay for them, but I want to get tickets for my friends."
Oh.
You know. So, I think like my parents hearing about the shows and getting he got the kudos indirectly, which probably meant more to him.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so is there anything you want to say about this production, how this wound up here, how you wound up here? You came with it.
Well, here's the thing about this play is that it's not about him per se, but it's this the setup of the play is Scalia and a new clerk that he's hired, and from time to time justices will hire what they call counter clerks, which are from the opposite political view.
Mm-hmm.
And they hire them to hone their own arguments.
Yeah, perfect.
Right?
Yeah, it's great.
So here we have the relationship between this young African-American woman.
Wow.
Who is a self-described flaming liberal.
Mm-hmm.
Helping him write The Descent, Defense of Marriage.
God.
Right? So how can we put these two people in a room and learn how to speak to each other civilly and with respect? So the play really is about civil discourse. It's
wow.
a model, it's a primer for civil discourse.
And could we not use it now?
Well, it was hot 2 years ago. It's only
now it's burning now. It's
exactly.
burning now.
So that's what I mean by John really put his finger on something.
Wow.
You know, some of these lines are prescient.
Yes.
That he wrote 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary. So I think even particularly with inauguration, we open on Inauguration Day, particularly his passing, his legacy is part of it now, particularly with finding his replacement. People are more aware of the Supreme Court now than I think they were 2 years ago.
Absolutely.
And, as I said after he passed away, I said, I certainly know that this character is part of my legacy, and I just hope that my playing it becomes a part of his.
Are they going to do a movie?
Don't know.
Well, never mind if they are. It'll just be, and that'll be it.
Right.
You don't have to think about that.
No.
Okay, good. No, all right, okay.
If Robert De Niro isn't available, I paid my phone bill. If that ever happens.
Yeah, no, I know. I have one more question. Okay. Having given a life to this work,
right.
Is there anything that you would say about what that's like? What you think about it, feel about it, any thoughts at all about what it's like to have given a life to the work of acting in theater?
That's a big question. I'm grateful that I've had the opportunity to do it, to live the life that has fulfilled me, has brought me an enormous amount of joy and learning, a community in Washington, that finding my way where I can have a family and a home and then have to be a nomad and just feel enormously satisfied. It's a remarkable gift. I'm very fortunate and grateful to all those who were there along the way and continue to be.
It's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Edward Gero. Indeed, a very fortunate person, Edward Gero. He was able so early in his life to know what mattered to him, what captured him, what intrigued him. And then, of course, what he needed to do with his life, who he really was. And having discovered it, having recognized that no, it wasn't the priesthood, it was acting. And then, not just acting, but classical acting. Ed grabbed onto that with both hands and didn't let go. Admittedly, he led a pretty magical life. As he said, it seems as though it was kind of written for him. People appreciated him and helped him. But then came the disappointment, what I called the breaking of his heart. At that point, a lot of people, for whom it had been so easy, might have surrendered it, might have given it up, might have said, oh, well, never mind. But he didn't do that. He continued to pursue. He continued to work. And because of that, what we have is not only a basically talented, but an extraordinarily skilled actor. And proof of that, of course, is in his performance as Antonin Scalia. You can come and see what he made of this decision, what he made of this passion, what he made of this commitment in this role, and you can see why the playwright had him in mind when he wrote it. By all means, come down and see Ed Gero in the original list. It is my hope, as always, that when you listen to Ed and hear what it sounds like to be an authentic human being, you are inspired to ask yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Is this how I approach the work I do, or the way I am, or the interactions that I have? Am I authentic?
Or am I hiding some important aspect of myself? Something I think, something I want, something I like to do, some way I am? Well, if you think that you are the person you really are, then I am delighted for you. If you think that there might be something that you are not accessing, some part of you that you needed to deny or hide, and you want to see if maybe you can recapture that, because I don't believe that it is too late. And if you want to talk to me about that, you can reach me at my website, thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. There's a tab up there that says email me. You can click on that and ask me any questions that you have. You can get me to come and speak to your group or organization. You can hear me reading the very first chapter of my book. You can listen to all the shows I've ever done, including this one. So, as always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show. As I said, inspiration to be the authentic you, or maybe just enjoying listening to this interesting story, but something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
See, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper, I may have gotten